This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a great pleasure for me to have on the show again the tremendous progressive sports writer and host of Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM, the one and only Dave Zirin. Zirin's the author of several path-breaking books on the politics of sports, including A People's History of Sports in the United States. His latest book is Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. Dave Zirin, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Hey, great to be here, Matt.
Love the book, by the way. There's a lot of great stuff in there, and I think the listener to this show in her car or in his kitchen or wherever, the person's listening will get a lot out of it, too. Bad Sports, great title, too. Let's start with George Steinbrenner. He's the biggest sports owner in this country over the last two decades and recently died, and I was amused and surprised to read in your book, Bad Sports, that you had an early encounter with Dave, with George Steinbrenner. Dave, please tell us that story.
No, absolutely. And the story only matters because it seems to be evocative of stories that a lot of people have about George Steinbrenner. And it has to do with who Steinbrenner was, which is really this bridge between an old-style patriarch and a new-age owner. And I'll explain what that means in a second. But first, to tell the story, I was living in New York City. I was just a kid. I was 12 years old, living with my mom on the west side of Manhattan. And every day I would read a column by New York Post columnist Dick Young. And this was back before the internet, of course. This was in the mid-1980s. So columnists were like popes. You know, there were very few of them, and they never left. And when Dick Young passed away, it was announced that there would be an open service funeral on the swank Upper East Side of Manhattan. So I figured, oh, this could be really interesting. There might be a lot of sports people there. There'll be fans there. I'm going to go. Well, Dick Young wasn't really liked. He was very pugnacious. He was very obnoxious. Frankly, if it was the age of the internet, myself and many others might have found someone else to read, to be frank. But, you know, I put on my suit, 12 years old, got on the crosstown bus, went over to the funeral. And when I got there, I realized that I was, like, the only fan there. No one else really took the opportunity to go. And instead, it was filled with New York sports glitterati. And I was standing at the doorway. I felt totally out of place. I saw people I only saw on TV, famous coaches, all of that. And I was about to slink away when I felt this big, thunderous hand on the back of my neck. And it starts shaking me. And he says, here's the guy. Here's the guy right here. And I look up, and it's George Steinbrenner. And I think, holy crap, it's George Steinbrenner. And then he sort of rudely pushes me in, and my goodness, people started flocking to me and saying, now who are you? And all of a sudden I was somebody at age 12 at a Park Avenue funeral. And he showed me a little bit of mercy that day, and I sat through the service and really got something out of it. And that's the story a lot of people had about Steinbrenner. Unfortunately, there was more to him than just that kind of old-timey patriarch. There was also the George Steinbrenner who became really the first owner to hold up a city for municipal funds and threaten to move the team if he didn't get them. He demanded $160 million in the late 70s while New York City was enduring its worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. And he got that money. And he did other things as well, which I think have equally stained not just his legacy, but all of sports ownership. Like, he used his team as a political way station for officials to curry favor with them. And, of course, he thought he knew more than any general manager out there. And this is something that a lot of us are afflicted with when it comes to modern ownership.
And you also have an anecdote, Dave Zirin, in this book, Bad Sports, about Steinbrenner that relates to another aspect of bad owners, and that is the way they totally politicize the playing field. I didn't know that he forced people not to leave their seats in the seventh inning stretch when the audience was almost required to stand and sing God Bless America.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, that was a post-9/11 thing, and that was something that a lot of teams adopted, just this idea of doing a second national anthem, playing God Bless America during the seventh inning stretch. And teams gradually dropped it or only did it on the weekends. And it was only at Steinbrenner's insistence that not only did it happen at every Yankees game, but he had them put up chains in the upper bleachers. Interestingly, this didn't happen in the lower bleachers, where you've got the high-end corporate seats, but in the upper bleachers. And if you attempted to actually step over those chains, as one gentleman did, he was rudely escorted from the stadium, and he sued with the help of the ACLU. I mean, it's kind of ironic if you think about it. Like, you better say God bless America or else. And you better support our freedom. And that was part of George Steinbrenner, too. He liked to brag that he was born on the 4th of July. But there was another Steinbrenner, too, and that's the Steinbrenner who died just in time to not pay estate taxes.
Oof.
He was really both of those people.
Sing God Bless America and you can't go to the bathroom. Man. That's pretty harsh.
God bless a toilet.
Dave Zirin, you pointed out another fact I didn't know on this topic, which is to say that the singing of the national anthem didn't really begin in as kind of mandatory until World War II. I mean, was it a common thing before that, and all of a sudden during the war it became everybody doing it? How'd that happen?
Well, that's exactly how it happened. It became de rigueur as part of the war effort. And, I mean, it says something about George Steinbrenner, honestly, that he believed in compulsory patriotism, the same way he once called manager Ralph Houck to ask him about the player's hair length, and he demanded that Ralph Houck really update him on the length of player's hair on the field, and Houck quit soon thereafter. And this was who George Steinbrenner was. I mean, one writer described him as a satanic CEO. He was someone who liked to brag, "I don't get heart attacks, I give them," which is kind of ironic that he died of a heart attack.
I mean, this aspect of owner as kind of a political dictator comes through loud and clear in the book Bad Sports that you just wrote, Dave. And I was amused by the story you report on Ed Snyder, owner of the Philadelphia Flyers, who had Sarah Palin drop the puck on opening night there. She wasn't well received, though.
No, and it was right during the election campaign in what was seen as the pivotal battleground state. Remember the whole thing about Obama could never win Pennsylvania. And, of course, he won it handily. But here's Ed Snyder lending his team, his hockey team, interestingly, not his basketball team, to Sarah Palin, the self-described hockey mom. And there's all this sort of weird sociological analysis we could even do about the phrase hockey mom. I mean, because it definitely infers someone who's white, and it also is a differentiation from the suburban soccer mom. So it's almost like it's who Palin is, this kind of like white resentment, but also anti-elitist formulation. And here's Ed Snyder absolutely feeding that and trying to use his team as a platform for her massive, massive ambitions and aspirations. And, of course, the Flyers fans booed her, even though she brought her daughter, one of her youngest daughters, I believe it was Piper, brought her on the ice with her. And when asked beforehand why she was bringing Piper on the ice, I mean, Sarah Palin, the person who drags her child with Down syndrome to public appearances, said she was doing it because she didn't think she'd be booed if Piper was out there. She actually said they wouldn't dare boo Piper. Well, guess what? They did.
She didn't understand Philadelphia fans, I guess. But
no, they didn't. These are the fans who once booed Santa Claus.
I still think there's a betting chance that Sarah Palin's going to be the next president of the United States. That's my nightmare.
But that's mine as well.
And think a lot of liberals, progressives, just think it's a joke, and I think they're fooling themselves.
Yeah.
Because that is a possible reality. My math is that she's got there's a 50% chance that she runs for the nomination. There's about a third of a chance she gets the nomination. If she gets it, there's about at least a 20% chance she beats Obama, maybe a lot more. So it's within the bettable realm, and I'm a poker player, and I've seen worse bets come true, I've got to say. The thing about Ed Snyder, though, I mean, not only did he have Sarah Palin there, Dave Zirin, but he also, you quote him as saying, if one of his own players said Bush should be impeached, we'd have a problem. That's an astonishing thing. I mean, these guys think they just own their players?
Yeah, they do, and it relates to some of the controversies that we saw recently when LeBron James went from the Cleveland Cavaliers to the Miami Heat, and the Cavaliers owner, Dan Gilbert, went apoplectic. And Jesse Jackson pointed out, I thought quite accurately pointed out, that to read Dan Gilbert's reaction, you wouldn't know if he owned the Cavs or felt like he owned LeBron James.
Yeah.
And Jesse Jackson took a lot of guff for that, but I don't see how you could read Gilbert's comments any other way.
Yeah, I mean, Jesse Jackson, he even mentioned, you know, slavery and plantation, I think, in that in that comment, and he did get a lot of heat for it. But I read a lot of players who had a similar reaction to that Dan Gilbert screed. You know, this idea that the player, you know, just owes his total existence to, you know, the benevolence of the Cleveland Cavalier coach or the city of Cleveland. I mean, what did you make of the whole decision by James?
Well, I'm of multiple minds on it, honestly, because on the one hand, I can't stand the decision he made, but at the same time, I totally stand with his right to make what I believe to be a horrible decision. I mean, this is why Curt Flood lost his livelihood in 1970 when he sued Major League Baseball for the right of free agency. It's why Spencer Haywood took the NBA to the Supreme Court. I mean, strikes and lockouts have happened over this among players' unions and among professional leagues. And this is what it's all about. I mean, LeBron James took slightly less money. LeBron James is taking second banana status. And LeBron James is going to what I believe to be the worst sports town in the United States. I hate all of these choices as an NBA diehard fan, but I have to say I rejoice in the fact that he gets to make these choices because players aren't chattel. They're not slaves, and they do get to have some control over their careers.
What do you make of the common gripe that you hear in bars all over the country that athletes just make too much money?
That's an interesting question, and that's actually something I certainly think about. I mean, we can't just act like players are like UAW workers. I mean, they're in unions, but it's not typical unions, of course, because they organize their contracts individually. So it's distorted because there's an aspect of collective bargaining, and there's an aspect not of collective bargaining. And one of the things that of the revenue streams that have created the high salaries is because of things like publicly funded stadiums, which are bad for working class people. But at the same time, given the current realities of the sports landscape, I mean, it's just a stone cold fact that if the players weren't making this money, it's not like it would flow back to the fans. It's not like there would be lower ticket prices. It would flow into ownership. I mean, it's a contested pie. And the typical fan really does have far more in common with a player than they do with ownership. But you can see how distorted it can become. I mean, you had working class people in Cleveland offering to pay off the fine that Dan Gilbert got for his screed against LeBron James. Here's Dan Gilbert, who made his money as the CEO of Quicken Loans, which offers, you know, those they call him subprime Dan, you know, 0% down, zero money. Oh, hey, what do you know? You owe us a ton of money. I'll have your house now. And, oh, guess what? I just opened some casinos. So if you want to pay your mortgage, you better go bet the family fund. I mean, this is who Dan Gilbert is, and they were treating him as almost a local hero for what he said about James. So, I mean, the irony is just astounding.
It is really turned around. I'm speaking with Dave Zirin. He's the author of a new book on sports called Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. Dave Zirin is the host of Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM. He's also a columnist for the Progressive Magazine and the sports editor for the Mighty Nation. In this book, you have a funny anecdote from Chris Rock on what Chris Rock says is the difference between being rich and being wealthy. Do you want to define that?
Sure, because it makes sense in all the sense in the world. He says, "Look, Shaquille O'Neal is rich. The guy who writes his checks is wealthy. Rich means you could lose all your money." Wealthy means it doesn't matter if your brother is a drug addict or if you have a crooked lawyer, you're still going to be just fine. And if you think about the first person who was signing checks for Shaquille O'Neal, it was Dick DeVos, the founder of Amway. He's a billionaire. He exists at that shadowy nexus as well as one of the great underwriters of the radical right wing in this country. And that's who we're trying to drag out of the shadows with this book. I say they operate on the basis of the Kaiser Sose principle. Just people, you might remember The Usual Suspects, and they said about Kaiser Sose that they said the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was making us think he didn't exist.
Yeah,
and a lot of these owners, they live in the shadows, and they affect our lives in ways that are really profound.
Dave Zirin, one of those owners, and I forgive me, I can't remember which, I think he's a billionaire, and he gave only three interviews and then said over like decades and said that's three interviews too much. Who was that guy?
Bill Anschutz. He's the minority owner of the L.A. Lakers, the L.A. Kings, and the L.A. Sparks, and which means he receives tons of tax breaks and public subsidies for that sports ownership. He's also the owner of the Weekly Standard, which is a hard, you know, right-wing neocon rag, and the Examiner newspapers, which are newspapers that are basically but to the right of the Washington Times. And Phil Anschutz operates those publications at a loss. They lose money. And so you see what's happening here is political money laundering. I mean, they get money with one hand, and then they pay it off. With the other, they support their political pet projects.
And several of these owners are doing their pet political projects, right-wing projects. You talk about Charlie Monford of the Colorado Rockies, and you mentioned Dick DeVos of Amway. Both of them are right-wing evangelicals. I mean, DeVos is a funder of the Dominionists, you say in this book, Bad Sports. Mm-hmm. And these are right-wing evangelicals.
These are theocrats.
Theocrats. They want to jail LGBTs. I couldn't believe that when I read it in your book.
Yeah, they're theocrats. And Dick DeVos is about to get a $480 million taxpayer-subsidized stadium in the middle of a $1 billion emporium that's being paid for on the public dime. Dick DeVos is also, by marriage, related to the Prince family, as in Eric Prince, as in Blackwater. His Eric Dick DeVos's son is married to C. Prince, whose brother is Eric Prince. Eric Prince, of course, received hundreds of millions of dollars in government contracts to basically have thugs murder people in Iraq and Afghanistan under the guise of private military contracting. If you think about this for a second. Dick DeVos gives big money that he got through public subsidies, and the money flows back into the Prince family, which is related to Dick DeVos. I mean, this is shady stuff here that's going on. And sports really has become a kind of Trojan horse for these right-wing projects.
Yeah, it's incredible to me to read about, for instance, the Colorado Rockies and how, you know, they brag about, you know, the character of their team or their players, and by that they mean that they have to be, you know, good Christians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the Colorado Rockies, the God Squad. And it's connected to a baseball thing called Faith Night at the Park, which is connected to Third Coast Sports as the company that organizes them, and they're connected to Focus on the Family. This is divisive. I mean, the ballpark should be, I think, a separation of church and ballpark, I think, should be something we all stand with.
Don't some of the athletes on those teams feel awkward, to say the least, if not irate?
Yeah, I've quoted a couple of them in the book, too. I mean, they feel like, yeah, they're looking through my locker to see if I have Playboys in there. I mean, it creates a very bizarre atmosphere. And on the Rockies, when the manager was Clint Hurdle, it's apparently different now under Jim Tracy, but when the manager was Clint Hurdle, it created an atmosphere on the club where people thought that, look, if you were down with the prayer circle, you were going to actually get benefits on the team. And Jesus, talk about something that Christ probably would have frowned upon.
My guest today is Dave Zirin. He's the author of Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. And full disclosure, Dave Zirin writes a monthly column for the Progressive. I think it was one of the more inspired things I've done in a not altogether inspiring career to invite Dave Zirin to be one of our columnists over the last couple of years, really spiced up the magazine. So thank you for that, Dave.
Are you kidding me? The magazine is fantastic, Matt. It's invaluable.
I appreciate that, but I don't want to overindulge here. One of the gists of your book is that publicly funded stadiums are basically a crime if they're left. The decisions about those teams are left in private hands. And you point out in a couple of examples, you know, there's a new stadium in New Orleans that, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars the levies are breaking. You know, there's the new stadium in St. Paul and the bridge breaks. It is just kind of shocking when you put those two things juxtaposed side by side.
Mm-hmm.
You quote Jim Boughton, the first sports book I ever read, I think, other than
Hotham.